The third case, I noticed some people came in and they may be here on the first case. I don't know where we're at. Are there lawyers and parties here on Mao?
I'm responding for Mao.
Mao? No appellants counsel yet?
I've never met her, so I'm not sure.
Okay. Are you here on Mao?
No, we're here for...
You're here on the third case?
Yeah.
Is that where you're calling Medina already?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yes, here's what happened. You're on Medina?
Yes.
Is it Medina? I don't know.
Sorry, I was in the cafeteria, so I was just...
Okay. Well, here's what happened. Counsel on the first case, there was a mix-up, and one of the lawyers didn't appear on time for the first case, so we actually jumped ahead a little bit and took the second case, meaning now that we're 20 minutes ahead for the third case, and the first case is still not ready to go. So if you want a few minutes to organize your papers and thoughts, you're welcome to have that, but if you're ready to go, we can take the Medina case.
I am also ready to go.
Okay. If you're ready, then I'll also thank you for being here early, as we ask in the notice, for just these sorts of occasions.
So one time that I went to the cafeteria and not the attorney working, so I'm kind of glad I talked over.
You were right on the money. You, like, walked in as the first, second case was leaving. All right. Absolutely. Take your time. I'm going to introduce the case. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, by the way. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today. With me are Judges Smith and Sleater. The next matter on the calendar is going to be State versus Medina. Counsel are here and ready to proceed on that, even though we're a few minutes early. We thank counsel for that. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes per rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. State your name and the party you represent when you begin your comments. As you've noticed already, the podium height is adjustable, so adjust that as you see fit. And whenever appellant's counsel is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Chang Lau. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant Ricardo Medina. In my brief, I raised two arguments. Today, I'd like to focus this court's attention on the first, and with time permitting, I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have regarding the second. The first argument itself is two parts, both attacking the sufficiency of the state's evidence on the mental state elements of robbery. The first part asks this court to reverse Mr. Medina's aiding and abetting robbery convictions because the state's circumstantial evidence supports an inference that Mr. Medina did not intend his actions to further the robbery of the alleged victim in this case, Nicholas Ron. The second part asks this court to reverse Mr. Medina's aiding and abetting robbery convictions because the state failed to prove Mr. Medina and Sharonda Little took Mr. Ron's money with the knowledge that they were not entitled to the money. Rather, there is a reasonable inference that they took the money believing they were entitled to it because Mr. Ron owed Mr. Money an outstanding debt. Now, under 609.24 and 609.245, a person is guilty of robbery if four elements are present. First, there must be a physical taking. Second, there has to be force or threats of imminent force. Third, that force or that threat has to be committed with the specific intent to overcome the resistance or powers of resistance or to compel acquiescence in the taking or carrying away of property. And fourth, the perpetrators have to know that they are not entitled to that property. Now, with regards to the first degree aggravated robbery, there is an added element that there is bodily harm, in addition to the four other elements. Now, in this case, the state's theory was that Sharonda Little and Mr. Medina each satisfied different elements of the robbery through their individual conduct. So according to the state's theory, Little took the $600 in buy money from Nicholas Ron, and under that same theory, Mr. Medina physically struck Ron with the intention of compelling Ron to turn over that money, to relinquish it. So to prove Mr. Medina aided and abetted robbery then, The state needed to prove Mr. Medina used or threatened imminent use of force with the specific purpose or intent of overcoming Mr. Ron's resistance or powers of resistance, or to compel acquiescence in the taking or carrying of Mr. Ron's money, or I guess it was the law enforcement's money. The state failed to do that here because there exists, based on the state's circumstantial evidence, a reasonable inference that Mr. Medina struck Mr. Ron because he thought Mr. Ron had, quote unquote, talked bad about him and, quote unquote, disrespected him, and not to compel him to turn over that $600. And that's based on the circumstantial evidence that was presented by the state, viewed in light most favorable to the verdict. I think the most compelling piece is that nobody in the course of this incident actually asked Mr. Ron for any money at the time that they were in the garage. Nobody asked how much money was on him. Nobody asked him about, what can you pay today? There was a discussion about a debt. If we take the state's evidence to be true, Mr. Medina did strike Mr. Ron, but the argument is that Mr. Medina is not guilty of that robbery or aiding and abetting robbery because the circumstances allow for the inference that he did it not to compel Mr. Ron to turn over the money, but instead in retaliation for the fact that Mr. Ron had sort of spoken badly about him.
Mr. Lau, isn't it true, though, the jury heard the evidence that in fact, he was there to purchase methamphetamine and that he had $600?
Yes.
So that information the jury could reasonably infer your client was aware of. Hence, you mentioned earlier about no knowledge of money. So they have that knowledge. Would that not be a significant part of the state's argument that, therefore, as you point out, the inferences in favor of the verdict, that indeed he knew there was money, that would be sufficient in and of itself for the verdict?
Well, I agree with Your Honor that the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, Mr. Ron did tell Sharonda Little that he had six big ones. And she testifies that she had no idea what that meant. But the inference from that is that Mr. Ron had told Sharonda Little that he was bringing $600 to buy some methamphetamine. But I think even assuming Ms. Little told Mr. Medina that Mr. Ron was coming with that $600, which there's no evidence to show. And we assume that Mr. Medina knew of that $600. I think there's still a rational or reasonable inference that Mr. Medina did not intend his actions or presence to further that robbery. Because again, if we step back and we look at the interaction in that recording, nobody asks for any money in the garage.
Well, but the way I read the transcript, and it's kind of confusing. I mean,
it's a little bit jarring.
Parties didn't have a court reporter present when all this was going on. But
that would be odd if there was.
It seems like there was a bunch of pushing and don't do this, Ricky, and a bunch of stuff, after which then the confidential informant individual says, here, I'll give you the money I've got.
Sure.
Isn't that the way it all comes together?
So at some point in the recording, Mr. Ron says, here, take this money. But I stand by the fact that nobody asks for it. So even
absolutely.
If
there was no give me the money
correct.
That you have, they're hitting him.
There's no asking for the money either.
There's a scuffle going on
correct.
After which he says, here, I will give you the money I got here.
So I do need to distinguish for the court Mr. Medina's intent to try to get money through force or threats of force, and Mr. Ron's perception as to what he needs to do in order to stop that force or those threats, right? So even if Mr. Ron thinks, okay, if I turn over the $600, this will stop, It does not mean Mr. Medina is thinking in his mind, if I continue to hit him, he will give me some money right now. And there is a reasonable inference, a rational inference, and I will say this, there is a rational inference that Mr. Medina is doing what he is doing to collect right at that moment. But the argument is that under the circumstantial evidence, that is not enough because there's a rational alternative inference that Mr. Medina is hitting Mr. Ron and in that garage to try to get Mr. Ron to pay on a future debt.
What evidence, if any, is there in the trial record about whether Ms. Little actually had methamphetamine in the garage?
The evidence is unclear on that fact. At some point in the recording, Mr. Ron himself says something like $600 for six ounces.
For 6 ounces?
That's a lot of methamphetamine. I don't know exactly what he's talking about, but it sounds like he's talking about some sort of exchange. Now, during trial, he says, I don't really understand what that meant myself. But that is something that he says in the recording. As far as whether or not he leaves with meth, as far as whether or not there was methamphetamine in that garage, it is entirely unclear.
He did not leave with any methamphetamine. We know that.
I would say that the record is not completely clear on that fact. I don't know that anybody testified that, you know, we checked him, we found that he had no methamphetamine on his person.
They may not have, but I mean, he says, here, I'll give you the money I got. And in the context of what was going on in the garage, it seems unlikely that at the end of that, Ms. Little would have, without saying anything, just slid him the methamphetamine that he wanted.
Well, it's unclear whether or not Ms. Little had given him meth before the alleged assault. Well, they walked over from Ms. Little's home to the garage.
But if she had given him the methamphetamine, she'd already have the $600, wouldn't she?
Well, it's unclear. I'd say at best. And I don't know that that fact is necessarily dispositive of our, you know, where the issue falls. At the end of the day, I would say if it's unclear and we have to look at the circumstances in the light most favorable to the verdict, there was no exchange of money for methamphetamine.
Right. That's usually what happens.
Right.
It's a hand.
I take your point. But I think the court should look to Mr. Ron's testimony over the course of the trial. He's there. He is there experiencing the circumstances. He is first-hand witness to what is happening. All these circumstances that we're trying to talk about, he is experiencing. He is the subject of the alleged assault. He is there allegedly having a gun pointed at him. And he says that Mr. Medina did not hit me because he wanted me to turn over this money. He hit me because I was going around town disrespecting him. I was talking bad about him.
I think, and I wanted to circle back a little bit before this, maybe I misunderstood. I think you also started to say that another alternative rational inference, one is that it was because he was disrespected and that's
correct.
Why he was hitting him. And I think you started to say something about for a future debt. Did I mishear you? What are you talking about there?
You didn't mishear me. I misspoke. Okay. I meant that he was trying to get him to make future payments on an existing debt.
Okay. Oh, that's consistent with guilt.
That is inconsistent with guilt. Because if he's trying to get him to make future payments, he is not doing anything to try to get Mr. Ron to turn over the money on him at that moment.
Oh, I see.
There's
not,
no taking.
Not future, like,
correct.
In a few seconds, give me that money. You mean a more distant future.
Correct. I'm not
I
saying
see. Okay.
I'm not using the future as in moments from now. It's more, because in the recording, I assume it's Mr. Medina, says something along the lines of, you know, in the next few weeks, pay $100 or $200, show us that you're at least making an effort. Something of that sort. Now, I have about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about the second part of the first issue. I personally think that is a more interesting issue. It is also a circumstantial evidence argument, and it has to do with the second mens rea element of robbery. And it's that Mr. Medina and Ms. Little did not know that they were not entitled to the money that Mr. Ron offered in to repay the loan, the outstanding debt that he had. And in my brief, I couch it in this sort of claim of right, this theft and trespass, theft and trespass cases. But what we're really relying on for that argument is the language of the statute and the case law that interprets it. And in those cases and the language of the statute, it's very clear that in order for you to be guilty of robbery, you have to know that you are not entitled to the money, the property that you take. And so here, the argument is that there is a reasonable inference, a rational inference, that Mr. Medina and Ms. Little thought they were entitled to the money that they took from Mr. Ron because he was offering it and there was an outstanding debt. So they did not know.
By all accounts, the outstanding debt was for previous sales of methamphetamine for which payment had not been made, right?
Correct.
So how does a person think or know that they're entitled to consummate the second half of an illegal transaction?
Well, to clarify, they don't need to know that they're entitled to it. They need to know that they are not entitled to it.
Okay, well, I'll ask the question that way.
Of course.
How would they think that they were in that? Same question asked in reverse. Right. I mean, it's an illegal transaction from the outset, right?
It is an illegal transaction from the outset, but the statute does not carve out an exception for illegal transactions. It does not say you need to know that you're not entitled to the property unless you don't know because the transactions that you were partaking in were illegal and the property derived from
that. But don't we all know that we're not entitled to money in exchange for illegal drugs?
I mean, legally speaking, perhaps.
Doesn't everybody know that? I mean, because otherwise methamphetamine dealers don't deal in garages. They just open stores.
Well, it's illegal to sell drugs. Yeah. I think everybody knows that. Now, whether or not you have the right to reclaim money for drugs that you'd already given, it's a hard answer. It's a hard question to answer about whether everybody knows. My argument here is that the circumstances, and my time is up.
You can go ahead and answer it. I asked the question.
Of course. And our position here is that the circumstances allow for the reasonable inference that Mr. Medina and Sharonda Little believed that they could rightfully take that money because of this outstanding debt. And again, the statute does not carve out an exception. So I would ask that the court reverse Mr. Medina's convictions. Thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use it. Ms. McGillick.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Karen McGillick. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This is a case involving, as we've already discussed, an aiding and abetting offense. And so in order to convict Mr. Medina of this offense, the state did not need to prove necessarily that he went in to punch this person to make him relinquish the money. The state's burden was to prove that he knew that his alleged accomplices were going to commit a crime, and he intended his presence or actions to further the commission of that crime. And Minnesota case law is very clear that in order to satisfy that, a person can play a knowing role in a crime by merely taking no steps to thwart its completion, and that their presence, companionship, and conduct before, after, and during the offense can help the jury infer the requisite intent. And in this case, we have extremely strong circumstantial evidence, as well as some direct evidence combined with it, that establishes that Mr. Medina had the requisite intent to aid and abet a robbery on the day of the offense. This is a drug offense that involved what has been referred to in the record as the Medina Organization. I don't know if I'm saying it right, Medina, I apologize. And what we know from the structure, from what's in the record, is that there's a person above appellant, But basically, it starts with appellant is the next person in line that we know of. Underneath him is this Travis Retzlaff and Sharon Little. And underneath them is the informant in this case, NR. So we know that the appellant in this case has a pretty high role in this Medina organization, and that this NR person owes a great deal of money to that organization for methamphetamine that was fronted to him and that was not paid.
And that was originally the methamphetamine given to him by Retzlaff?
Correct.
Not by Medina.
Right. Now, Medina funnels the money down to Retzlaff.
Presumably going to give the money to Medina.
Correct.
Okay.
And so we have a chain of people here who are owed money. Now, what we know about the controlled buy that was supposed to happen is that Sharon Little, these people are all acquainted. So we know that this companionship exists between Little, Retzlaff, appellant, and even the informant, NR. And we know that prior to NR coming to Little's house on the day of the controlled buy, none of the individuals involved were aware that it was a controlled buy, obviously, other than the informant.
Can I just ask a framing question as you're telling the facts so I know what I'm thinking about when you're telling me about these facts? Is the state's argument, let's assume for purposes of argument, that we were to agree with appellant, that there was a reasonable alternative inference of why the appellant struck the informant? Okay, it wasn't to get money. It was because he was unhappy about bad talk about him. Can the state? Are you arguing that the state can still, there's still sufficient evidence to support the verdict, or are you about to argue why that's not a rational inference?
I think the answer is both. I think that is not a rational inference based on the entire totality of the circumstances of this case. I think it is very clear that the disrespect that was being involved in this Medina organization related to him not paying his debts and going around town, and apparently he's talking about that. So I think that there's a direct connection between this disrespect and this owed money and why he was being assaulted and why they were robbing him that day of what money he had on his person. So I don't believe that that's a rational inference to assume that they're unrelated. But that said, I don't think we need to prove a direct connection between the actual physical assault and what the purpose of the assault was, because it's enough to show that his presence, that he knew that the people in the garage, we have Anderson, who has apparently was testified had a gun with him, pointed at the informant at least for a small amount of time. We know that in the process of the physical assault that's occurring, Little takes the money away. We know that the person who has had the money removed from them is now injured and is pleading for this assault to stop and is now begging essentially, what can I do to fix this? Let's work something out. And they go on to discuss then how to make good on this debt in the future. So at this point, we have proof that he is part of this. He is involved and participating in the commission of taking this money forcibly from the informant. And as Little's removing the money, he is the person highest up in this chain of command in this drug organization who's running the show. And we know that because the best evidence we have of what occurred is the audio recording that the informant had on him as this was occurring, an unusual thing to have in a circumstance involving an armed robbery, frankly. Now, what he testifies on the stand about the order of events in terms of when he was punched and when the money was taken by Little and all of this, I mean, he's sitting in a courtroom staring down the defendant. He's scared. We know that this is a drug organization. Threats have been made that he's going to be injured. I'm sure he's scared to testify. But we don't have to just take the informant's word a couple years later about what happened, because we can see right in the transcript of the recording of the event how it occurred, which is that very quickly in the very beginning of the confrontation, Mr. Medina walks in. They say a couple words. He starts assaulting the victim. The victim quickly turns over the money, not because he wanted to turn over the money, but because he felt he had no choice at this point. He has a gun pointed at him, and he's being punched in the face. And that after that, he's still not feeling as though he's free to leave or able to do anything, because there is a discussion being had about money he owes, how he's going to pay it, how he's going to lie about what happened to his face, and how he's going to walk out of here and start making good on this so-called debt.
Ms. McGillig, is it critical then, in answer you gave to Judge Smith, that the jury was aware that apparently Mr. Medina was aware that he was carrying money?
Yes.
So if that evidence was out, would you agree that there'd be no evidence? The only inferences would be something other than a robbery. In other words, let's assume everything else came down the same. He happened to have $600 on him, but there was no knowledge. It wasn't part of a controlled buy, but he was carrying it.
What we have is we have Little's testimony at trial that she told Mr. Medina before the informant arrived that he was going to be coming with six big ones to buy methamphetamine. And we also have evidence in the record that before the buy was set to start that evening, the appellant went outside, moved his motorcycle, and concealed it so that it looked as though he was no longer there, and that they sort of set the scene so that the informant would walk into a trap thinking he was going to buy drugs, Little would lead him into the garage, and then Anderson and Medina would ambush him in the garage and proceed with the robbery. So that's what, viewing the evidence lies most favorable to the verdict, that's what the circumstances prove show. Now, in addition to that, if we were to take away Little's testimony that directly says that I told appellant he was coming here with money, we know from case law, like the Smith case, for example, that knowledge of what's occurring doesn't have to form before the crime. So even if Medina didn't know going into the garage that he was going to have money, once he struck the victim and the victim offered the money, let's say offered it or Little took it or however that transaction occurred, once he saw that that person was being robbed by his accomplices and he did nothing to stop it or thwart the completion of that crime and actively participated in it by rendering the victim helpless, by injuring him, by threatening him with future injury to accomplish that robbery, he has now, that establishes, those circumstances prove, satisfy that mens rea element that needs to be proven in terms of his knowledge. And the case law is very clear about that. So in this case, I think the state can prevail under either way. I think we have to assume that the jury believed the state's witnesses. I mean, that's part of the standard of review. And so Little's testimony is very key there, but it's also, you know, sort of an additional thing that we wouldn't even need necessarily in order to prevail. So, you know, getting further on into what did the state prove about how, you know, the circumstances proved actually established these knowledge elements. We have this association between these defendants. We have anger that this person highest up in the chain of these people in the garage has over an unpaid debt. We know that he went out there, according to Little's testimony, knowing that he would be arriving with money. And then there's certainly no expression of surprise or concern when Little takes the money with him. There was a question during...
When Little takes the money with him.
Takes the money from him, from the informant.
I understand.
And whether or not methamphetamine exchanged hands. I mean, again, this was a controlled buy, so we had testimony in the record about the pre-buy procedure where they searched the informant's car and his person, and then there was a post-buy meeting that occurs in every controlled buy where he went into the place, and they redo that searching process. So I think the record does establish that there was no methamphetamine exchange during this buy.
Was there any methamphetamine even present in the garage?
I don't know that we know that. We know that at the time that Anderson and I think it's Gunther were arrested later that night, that they both had methamphetamine on their person, but there's no way to know if that methamphetamine was in the garage or whether that was something that they had in the house.
And there's no evidence that there had been an exchange of methamphetamine to the informant earlier.
No. Because we know that the police searched him, you know, the officers, the agents involved in the controlled buy searched him before the buy. They watched him go into the garage. They followed him with, you know, video or audio surveillance through the phone and visual surveillance as they followed him back to the post-buy meeting location. They repeated their search procedure. So we know that he didn't obtain any methamphetamine.
So is one of the circumstances proved for purposes of the first step of the Al-Nusseir analysis, even that there was any methamphetamine to exchange?
I believe that the circumstances proved in the light most favorable to the verdict is that this was an ambush. Little set him up, you know, told him come buy methamphetamine. He said he'd show up with money, and there was never an intent to exchange methamphetamine. The intent was to rob him of the money and to do so in order to teach him a lesson that he wasn't going to get away with this debt any longer. He wasn't going to get away with disrespecting the organization by going around town not paying his debt and thinking he could do that. And they were going to make sure that he was physically injured and scared enough to work off that debt in the future. So I think that's what the circumstances prove show. And it's not just what I think. I mean, that is what viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the verdict shows. And in turn, that shows both his knowledge The fact that he showed up ahead of time, the fact that he concealed his motorcycle, the fact that he has a close association with his people, that he was the one in control of this confrontation. He isn't standing in the background. This isn't a mere presence case. He's actively the person, the first person to strike the victim, the first person to talk to the victim, to get in his face and tell him how things are going to be. Mr. Medina runs the show. And by the time that he leaves, it's then Little and Medina who get on the motorcycle and flee the scene. And when they return to the scene later and they find that there are police everywhere executing a search warrant, they flee the scene again. So these are all circumstances that the jury is allowed to infer his intent, that he understood exactly what this crime was going to be. And not only that, he intended his actions to further the commission of this crime. He was actively participating, not just merely present as it was occurring.
Right. I think the question isn't whether the jury could infer that. The question is whether one could reasonably infer something else.
Right. And the state's position is there is no reasonable inference of innocence on these facts. There is simply no evidence that would support the idea that he, number one, didn't understand, most likely before it occurred, but minimally as it was occurring, that this was a robbery, that when somebody has been struck in the face, has a gun pointed at their head, and relinquishes money to three individuals in a garage when that person is on their own, there is no reasonable inference on those facts of innocence that this was not an active robbery that this person was participating in, aiding and abetting in.
Can you speak to the second part of the argument on sufficiency with whether Medina knew that he was not entitled to the money? And I think there are two questions around that. Let's assume a debt. Let's just assume a debt for legitimate reasons, and let's assume a debt that arises from illegitimate ones like drug sale. How does that fact, what's the state's position with respect to that element, that you know you're not entitled to it? If there's a debt, even if it's legitimate, can you still be entitled to it just because a person has money on their person and they owe you money legitimately or not?
No, and certainly not to take it by use of force. And as I mentioned in my brief, there is no Minnesota case law that sort of directly, that I could find anyway, that directly gets at the issue. But when I looked at the other cases in other jurisdictions that have examined the issue, it's very clear that this sort of claim of right to property would involve property, you know, a piece of jewelry, something that you can actually establish is yours and you belong to. And that's actually a key component, is the defendant has to prove that they had a valid ownership interest in this property. But money itself, money that's owed for a debt, other jurisdictions have rejected the idea that you can have a claim of right to money based on a debt. And beyond that, even if you're owed money, you have no valid claim of right to use force to injure or threaten the person in order to give you that money. Now you layer on the fact that we're talking about an illegal drug debt, and I think there is no way that they can argue validly that these defendants had a valid claim of right to illegal money owed on illegal drug sales and claim that the money in his pocket, somehow that they had an ownership interest in it that was valid and a valid claim of right to. That just doesn't exist, and particularly under these circumstances. So what we do have is we have evidence that they knew they're not entitled to illegal drug money. They know they're not entitled to forcibly injure and threaten someone in order to take that money. And as a group, they went forward with the crime together and aided and abetted each other in robbing this person and injuring him in the process, which satisfies the requirement for a first-degree aggravated robbery.
It appears we have no additional questions. Thank
you. And I am out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Lau.
So I have a few points I'd like to clarify, but if I clarify no other points, I'd like to clarify one. Is what crime are we talking about that Mr. Medina aided and abetted in? Okay, so there was the state talks about the gun, Evan Anderson's role in the alleged offense. It's fairly clear from the record that Mr. Medina does not aid and abet in a robbery wherein Mr. Anderson points a gun at Mr. Ron and Ms. Lil takes the money. And we know that because A, Mr. Ron, and this is uncontroverted, testifies that immediately after
Mr. Anderson takes out the gun. Without saying anything further, Mr. Medina tells Mr. Ron to put the gun, or excuse me, Mr. Anderson to put the gun away. So he's affirmatively telling him, don't do this. And second, the jury is not actually instructed on robbery in that way. It's not he is guilty of robbery if you find that there's a dangerous weapon there. It's he is guilty of robbery if there's bodily harm. Now, third, even if we assume.
Do you agree, by the way, that there was bodily harm? You don't contest that?
We do not contest it.
Okay.
I mean, for the purposes of the right. circumstantial evidence standard, I don't think we can. But even if we assume that Mr. Medina knew about the gun, intended for the gun to be taken out and pointed at Mr. Ron, we still have to step back and listen to the entire recording and realize that nobody is asking Mr. Ron for money. Mr. Anderson certainly is not. Mr. Medina is not at that moment, right? And so if the gun is not in play, then what is the actual crime? What does the state need to prove in order to show that a robbery actually happened? There needs to be force. There needs to be intentional force, and there needs to be a taking. So what is the force or threat of imminent force if not the gun? Then it's what the state alleged to be an assault by Mr. Medina. And so there is no alternative proving of aiding and abetting without the force that Mr. Medina used. If that force was not meant for, if Mr. Medina's assault was not meant to compel Mr. Ron to turn over the money from his person, then there is no robbery because there is no force or threat of imminent force. Now, the other thing I want to touch on is this sort of, you know, there's an ambush. Everybody knows that everybody's what everybody else is doing. You know, that evidence shows that there's a robbery. No, it doesn't. I think it shows that they're planning to do something, right? That this group of people is planning to commit some crime. We can call it assault. We can call it coercion. We can call it, you know, false imprisonment. Those things weren't charged. Those things were not charged. The state chose to charge this as a robbery. And so perhaps all the circumstantial evidence that the state pointed out tend to show that there was some plan to commit an illicit act, but it does not show, to the exclusion of all other inferences, that a robbery actually occurred in this case.
Can you speak to the question of the entitlement, not knowing entitled to the money? I mean, sure. When we're talking about fungible money, which is fungible.
Right.
I mean, if someone owes their landlord, they might have a car payment, they might owe money on myriad things. Why is that money in a person's pocket? Oh, you know, why is that other person entitled to that particular money in a person's pocket when presumably they might have all sorts of debts?
I think the key fact here is the fact that Mr. Ron offered that money to pay the debt, right? In the recording that the state presented as evidence, Mr. Ron says, here, take the $600. And again, there's not strong evidence that anybody asked for that money. He offers it.
Right,
and
but
so,
I think your argument is even if it had been forced to be given, that because there was an entitlement to it, because there was a debt, you can't prove that element.
And so this kind of
bleeds. It's not an offering issue.
Excuse me. So this sort of bleeds into that third argument. It's a distinction between being entitled to take the money in the manner that you do or being entitled to the money, right? And certainly, you know, for various reasons, Mr. Medina, Ms. Little, they're not entitled to take the money in the way that they do. I'm still arguing that it's not a robbery, but they're not entitled to do that. But because Mr. Ron is offering it, they are entitled to the money because there is still that debt in their minds. And so given that fact, given those circumstances, I think there is a reasonable inference that they believed, and I see that my time is up.
You can go ahead and finish.
I do believe that there is a reasonable inference that they thought that since he's offering this money to pay this debt, we are entitled to it. Therefore, they don't know that they are not, which, you know, shows that they are not guilty of robbery. And for those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse Mr. Medina's convictions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days. We thank counsel for your briefing, for your argument, and for being here timely so that we could keep right on going through the calendar.